This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm Wade Clark Roof, Director of the Walter H. Capp Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life at UCSB. And I welcome you to this lecture. This lecture on cyber war, technologically. Now in its 12th year, the Capp Center promotes conversations about how ethical teachings and values relate to civic life through a series of programs that include public lectures such as this one, both downtown and on campus at UCSB. We have four undergraduate courses on ethics, one on business, one on the environment, one on biomedical issues, and one on social justice issues. We also have the Sarah Miller McCune Internship and Public Service Program, which enables 15 undergraduates each year to volunteer in nonprofit government agencies and congressional offices in Washington, D.C., Sacramento, and of course here in Santa Barbara. I want to acknowledge a special guest with us. Congresswoman Lois Capps is here. Nice to have you and some members of the Capps family. Also want to thank Leonard Wallach, the Associate Director of the Capps Center, for all he does to make these events as good as they are. Also want to recognize Kelly Coleman Moore. I cannot see from here where she is, but she's somewhere out there. Thank you, Kelly. And also Hannah Bartlebaugh, our undergraduate assistant. And we have two former interns assisting us this evening, Laura Barley and Rachel Siegel. Thank you. I'm supposed to announce from the management here, no filming or photography allowed. After the lecture, there will be time, some time, for Q&A. If you have a question, please come to one of the microphones, wherever they are. They're back there. Oh, okay. You see them, I can't, but that's okay. As long as they're there. Shane Harris's book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex, is available for purchase in the foyer, and it's available for signing. We're indebted to the Book Den for making this book available for you. You can buy them in the back, but the signing will be up here on the stage later on, and you can come up and meet him. He'll be sitting here on the stage. Ever since the news broke about the hijacking of Sony Studios some months ago, we've been on alert about the threat of cyber war. Defending computer networks in the United States from spies and hackers has become a top priority for security. Tonight we have an authority on the topic, Shane Harris, who will speak on the ethics of cyber war and how the rules and ethics of such war are evolving. Harris is an award-winning author and journalist who currently serves as senior correspondent at the Daily Beast, where he covers national security, intelligence, and cybersecurity. His earlier book, The Watchers, The Rise of the American Surveillance State, was named one of the best books in 2010 by The Economist. His recent book, the one that he will be speaking about this evening, was described as, quote, extraordinary and urgent by The Washington Post. Please welcome Shane Harris. This is the book.
Thank you very much for coming out. I thought maybe the NSA hacked the microphone earlier there for a second. I'm glad to see that's all working okay. Thank you all for being here tonight, and thanks to the CAP Center for offering me the chance to free the unusually snowy and icy confines of our nation's capital. It's usually a good time to get out of Washington any day of the week, in my opinion, but it's been especially chilly and cold there of late. Although I was a little bit upset that this is apparently like the one overcast day you guys have had in a long time. So if that was my fault, I apologize in advance. I have to say, I was really delighted and a little bit surprised even when the CAP Center sent me this invitation to talk about the ethics of cyber war, because I thought, well, what a perfect topic for discussion and one that really isn't pondered enough right now, I think, in Washington, in the military and the intelligence circles, where it's fair to say that cybersecurity and defending against hackers and defending our infrastructure and our data, but also spying on other countries and thinking about how to launch attacks on their infrastructure, has sort of become a unique obsession in the corners of national security. But we don't really often talk about the ethical dimensions of that, which are so plainly embedded in many of the decisions and many of the policies that are evolving, which hopefully I'll shed some light on tonight. It's fair to say that right now in Washington, we're sort of consumed with legal and policy dimensions, which I have to say, in this domain as it's evolving, and that the military calls cyberspace a domain, this is the way it sees it, as a battlefield, really, those legal questions are hard enough to answer and are puzzling. Cyberspace being a sort of boundaryless region that does not necessarily obey neat geographic restrictions, and certainly where we do not find any opportunity, at least now, for treaties to try and govern how nations should behave with each other in that space. So the idea of looking at the ethical dimensions of this seemed just really too good of an opportunity to pass up. So, as I say, I think it's fair to say that this is right now, and as we've said in the introduction, cybersecurity has become this national security priority. I mean, it has really kind of elevated in the past 4 or 5 years to the top of the agenda, and really, I think, came into great public view with the hacking on Sony. But it's fair to say that, you know, this is no longer seen as a theoretical threat or problem by the leaders of our national security community. In fact, that was the quote from the current NSA director, Admiral Michael Rogers, who also runs an organization called Cyber Command, which is sort of the DOD's center of gravity for military operations in cyberspace. When he testified about this before the Congress a few months ago, and said, "This is not theoretical," referring, that is, to the risk that another nation could attack us, disable portions of our infrastructure, a power grid, a large utility, by attacking computers that run those systems and that are connected to the internet and are vulnerable to intruders. Rogers told Congress that it was, quote, literally costing us hundreds of billions of dollars when it comes to cyber spies stealing intellectual property and other trade secrets from U.S. companies and then giving it to their own companies in their countries or using it for advantage. And he predicted that cyber attacks will have a, quote, truly significant, almost catastrophic, resulting truly significant, almost catastrophic failures if we don't take action. This coming from one of the top intelligence and national security officials in the United States. For the past 3 years, the threat of a major cyber attack, as well as cyber espionage, has been at the top or near the list of the intelligence community's list of what they call global threats. Director James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, just presented that list, actually, to Congress a few weeks ago. The current FBI Director, James Comey, has said that the risks of cyber attacks and a rise in cyber-related crime, to include espionage and financial fraud, will be the most significant national security threat over the next decade. This coming from the head of an organization in which the threat of terrorism on U.S. soil and against U.S. interests has been the top national security threat for more than the past decade. So here you have the FBI director saying cybersecurity is now the big new thing to worry about. So how did that happen exactly? How is it that this idea of threats from hackers and intruders that we cannot see, using information, perhaps causing economic damage that we can't really feel, maybe creating threat and risk to life, how did that become something that is such an obsession for the leaders of our country and our military and intelligence officials? Well, I tell a lot of stories in the book that try to get at that and explain why it is that this has become such a priority. And I'll start with a couple of stories that I think really set the stage for this. And the first one is from May of 2007. You have to put yourself in the Oval Office for this story. And George Bush is the president, and he has called a meeting of his top national security officials to include the Director of National Intelligence, the Treasury Secretary, his National Security Advisor, his Counterterrorism Advisor, and a host of other officials. And they've gotten together to talk specifically about the issue of cyber threats and cyber attacks on U.S. companies and on U.S. infrastructure. And it's not really dawning on President Bush how it is that our internet, our communication system, which he is not necessarily intimately familiar with himself but understands it to be out there, how is it that people could penetrate this and cause such great damage and potentially destruction? So his intelligence director, a man named Mike McConnell, who used to run the National Security Agency, decides to analogize this in a way that he thinks that the president can understand to physical acts of terrorism. And he says, imagine, Mr. President, if on 9/11, the terrorists were not hijackers of airplanes, but rather were computer hackers. And rather than flying into the World Trade Center, what they did was they broke into the networks of a major U.S. bank or a financial exchange and erased data or manipulated it in such a way that we could no longer be confident that that data was accurate, that we could no longer be confident what the balances were in accounts, what the prices of a trade were, when a transaction was closed. That manipulation of information could trigger a financial panic. And McConnell told Bush that the effects of that on the economy would actually be worse than the economic effects of the physical attack on 9/11, which, of course, we remember exacerbated an already pretty bad recession. And Bush is sort of incredulous to this point, and he looks over to Henry Paulson, his Treasury Secretary, who, of course, used to be the CEO of Goldman Sachs, and he says, "Hank, is what Mike is saying true?" And Paulson looks at him and says, and they're kind of sharing a moment, McConnell and Paulson here, where they know this is the time to clue in the president to how bad things have gotten. He says, "Mr. President, not only is what McConnell is saying true, but when I was running Goldman Sachs, this is the very scenario that kept me up at night. This is the thing that scared me more than anything else." And Bush, who is, I think, not known for melodramatics, as I'm told by people who were in the room, actually stands up from his chair. He's so sort of moved by this, and tells the room that the internet is our strategic advantage, economically, politically, for the next coming decades, and we will do whatever we have to do to protect it. And Bush says, quote, "I will launch another Manhattan Project if I have to." So in this really searing moment, the President of the United States finally gets it and clues in that there is this major vulnerability to our strategic and our economic well-being, something that plenty of people in that room had known for a long time but had never been able to quite convey to him. And there's another story that occurs a few months later, this one not far from the White House at the Pentagon in the summer of 2007. And for this story, you have to put yourself in one of these rooms called a SCIF that you've probably seen if you watch Homeland or any spy movies. This is the place where when people go in to talk about really secret information, they step into a sealed room and they put their cell phones outside and any recording equipment. Well, a bunch of CEOs of the major defense contractors in the United States, your Boeings, Raytheons, Northrop Grumman's, Lockheed Martin's and the like, are called over for a high-level meeting at the Pentagon inside of a SCIF. And they're not sure exactly why they've been called here, and they're looking around, and you're probably thinking that if you're in a room full of your big competitors at the Pentagon, it's probably not good news that you're about to hear. And true enough, senior military officials begin for these CEOs what they've built as a threat briefing. And they show them diagrams and information illustrating how hackers believed to be operating in China have penetrated computer systems in the United States and compromised or stolen information about some of America's most sensitive and important weapons programs, in particular something for programs called the J-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, sorry, the most important and expensive weapon system really perhaps ever that the Pentagon has undertaken. This is a fighter program that is supposed to end all fighters and be the kind of ultimate weapon in our air arsenal. And so these executives are being shown how these hackers have essentially overrun these networks, stolen these secrets, and made off with this prize information about America's military arsenal. But there's a catch here. They didn't get into the Pentagon's networks. They didn't steal this information from the Air Force. They stole it by going around those systems and taking it from the contractors, from the companies that these CEOs represent and lead. The Pentagon is essentially saying to them, we've discovered this massive vulnerability in our information security, and it's you. You are the weak link in the chain. Our networks are quite well defended. You guys are doing a terrible job, and these spies are not idiots. They've figured out that you are running our projects, you're working on these, we're paying you to build these weapon systems. You have all the information they want, and that's how they're getting it. And you're going to ramp up your security, and you're going to cooperate with us to do that. And from that moment actually began a huge new joint initiative to work with the private sector to defend cyberspace. Not exactly on the order of a Manhattan Project as Bush had envisioned it, but in this time in 2007, you suddenly have major parts of our national security apparatus clicking into gear and deciding it is time for government to do something to defend against these vulnerabilities, to keep the spies out, and they're going to partner with the private sector to do that. And I like both these stories because they illustrate the degree to which, in that period in 2007, the awareness of these threats had started to reach an almost fever pitch in Washington. And reporting on this, you could really feel it, kind of people like light bulbs going off all around town. And we didn't learn until much later what the contours of these plans that developed were exactly, but you could hear rumblings about it and you knew something was happening within the halls of the national security community. I like telling the story about the Pentagon in particular because it really has kind of come to epitomize how it is that the government approaches this massive challenge of defending computer networks, whether they be networks that have government information and secrets or even networks like Sony and those that are run by our electrical companies and our public utilities. Simply put, there has become a huge public and private partnership for defending cyberspace in the United States, in which companies play an essential role and which raises all kinds of ethical challenges and dimensions, frankly. 85% of what we would know as the internet in this country, the networks that run information and that carry data from point to point, are privately owned. They're owned by internet service providers. They're owned by companies. The government does not control them. It does not regulate them, at least not yet. And it often has very little to say about how they're managed and certainly very little to say sometimes about the security of those particular networks. Out of that Pentagon meeting began this initiative whereby the government decided to start sharing with these companies, this select group of defense contractors that were deemed vitally important to the national interest, essentially the fruits of espionage. It started saying to them, we have information about what hackers in China and other countries are doing, how we think they're getting into your networks. We're going to share this information, this highly classified information, with you because we trust you and because we deem you to be essential. And what we expect you to do is start sharing back with us the information that you're also seeing on your networks and start talking to each other. It's kind of like a team sport, if you like, and trying to create sentries in cyberspace to be prepared to repel all of these advances that are coming at us from our adversaries. Embedded in that whole idea is a sort of central idea on the government's part that it cannot possibly protect all these networks on its own. And that's something that's very important to remember as we talk about national cybersecurity, is that the government has long ago come to the conclusion that it cannot do this by itself, that it's going to require companies participating with it and sharing information about its networks and, yes, in many cases, about its customers, that is, all of us. This whole idea of this public and private sector coming together has expanded. That initial group of companies that were in the Pentagon back in 2007, it started out with about a dozen members in that plan. It's now expanded to more than 100, and the Pentagon wants to grow it to 200 companies. It's no longer just the top-tier defense contractors. It's lots of companies that are working for the government. It's expanded to internet service providers. There's actually a program now where the National Security Agency, via our Homeland Security Department, gives what are called threat signatures, or information about how hackers are trying to break into U.S. networks, to the internet service providers in the hopes that they will filter traffic and then be able to protect their customers downstream. Major marquee technology companies have formed partnerships and alliances, many of which we don't know a lot about, with the intelligence community. Notably, Google, which a few years ago came out publicly and said that it had been hacked by spies in China and had seen some of its intellectual property stolen, entered into an agreement with the National Security Agency whereby both parties are supposed to share information with each other about the threats that they're seeing, which makes great sense from the government's point of view because Google has a very wide perch over the internet and sees a lot of what's going on in the world's internet traffic. So defending cyberspace and attacking in it as well has become a cooperative effort between government and the intelligence community and its partners in the technology industry, some of them willing, some of them compelled legally to participate. This agreement, which I refer to in the book as the military internet complex, this sort of coming together of these two sides, really took off in the Obama administration, which practically from day one made cybersecurity a huge priority, even in ways that President Bush hadn't. You know, Bush kind of clued in at the very end of his presidency, I think in part because of his lack of familiarity with technology. And this is a president who, after all, once said that he uses the Google to look at pictures of his ranch in Texas. At the same time, we should say in all fairness that his predecessor, Bill Clinton, has said that he sent 2 emails in his entire life when he was president of the United States. I'm not sure whether they're still contained on a server in New York someplace. I had to work that in. So fair to say that Barack Obama comes in, though, with a completely different understanding than his predecessors of what cyberspace is. I mean, he is arguably the first internet president. He used text messaging and blogs and social media to develop his base, to raise money, to activate people. He organized through cyberspace. Organizing was something that he understood very, very well. So he comes in really ready to make this a top national security priority. Arguably, you know, if John McCain had been elected president, I don't know that it necessarily would have gone down this path. But Obama comes in wanting to make this an issue because he gets it. He'd even had personal experience with this. He was actually hacked on the campaign trail. Spies believed to be in China. A lot of this comes from China, but the Russians are very active in cyber espionage too, hacked into his campaign email system. And they did for John McCain as well, by the way. So he comes in pretty well grasping the nature of cyberspace and the threats that exist in it, and to him and the people around him as well. And so in May 2009, just 5 months after he's taken office, he gives a speech in the East Room of the White House to unveil his plan for a national comprehensive cybersecurity strategy. And the East Room is really reserved, if you've ever been there in the White House, for the really big, momentous speeches. It's the one where they invite a lot of guests. They have a lot of important people. They kind of shunt us journalists off to the side with ropes. But it was a really, really big speech. And he did something quite extraordinary in that moment. Up until that point, the kinds of threats that had been described to President Bush in the Oval Office in 2007, hackers taking out part of the banking system, hackers taking out part of the electrical power grid, had been speculative and really kind of rumored and very hush-hush and only talked about in very off-the-record settings with national security officials and people like myself. The President of the United States came out and essentially said it's already happened. He publicly said that we were aware of foreign agents, foreign sources, hackers, probing the systems in the United States that control our power grid. I mean, this is really kind of a show-stopping moment to hear the president say this, and actually said that we knew of one incident overseas in a country that he wouldn't name where hackers had actually plunged part of a city into darkness. an astonishing moment to hear the commander-in-chief saying this and saying essentially that the era of cyber war is already upon us, and now it's time to do something about it. And he hearkened back to this whole idea that we cannot do this alone, that this is a partnership that we have to engage in with business, with the citizenry, when he said the vast majority of our critical infrastructure in the United States is owned and operated by the private sector, and we will collaborate with industry to find solutions that ensure our security and promote prosperity. I mean, just think about that statement for a second. Usually, solutions that ensure our security and promote our prosperity are things that we think of as the domain of the government. That is the government's job. And here what he is saying is this is now the job of the government and the people who effectively own cyberspace or who control it and exert influence over it. Obama ended the speech by saying that he viewed the internet as a strategic national asset and that it would be the policy of his administration to protect it as such. Really, really important moment in the history of how Washington began to see cyberspace as more than just a collection of computers, but as something that was vital to our national interest, to our prosperity, and to our collective security. So Obama, like Bush before him, is describing cyberspace, I think, as a battlefield. And that is exactly what the military now views it as, and the intelligence community as well. You hear generals speaking frequently about military, the cyberspace is the fifth domain of warfare, after air, land, sea, and outer space. And the military has decided that having dominance in that space, or as close as it can get to dominance, is as important as it is in the other four, where the United States, I think, is uncontested. Now, in Washington, it's sort of a truism that if you really want to understand where the priorities are, you can follow the money, and you can see where the money is being allocated. And that is definitely true when it comes to our spending on cyber defense and also on cyber offense, which is a lot harder to pin down because it's contained in the secret classified parts of our budget. But just to give you a little flavor of this, in 2014, the U.S. government plans to spend more than $13 billion on cyber defense programs, and that's mostly to protect government computers and networks and to share intelligence with private industry. To put that number in perspective, that $13 billion number. In 2014, the government plans to spend $11.6 billion on direct efforts to combat climate change, which Obama has called, quote, the global threat of our time. So we're spending less on direct efforts to combat climate change than we are on this one portion of cybersecurity. The 2012 Pentagon budget had the word cyber in it 12 times. The 2014 Pentagon budget had the word cyber in it 147 times. Just as a rhetorical evolution, that is shocking that in 2 years it went from a dozen to 147 times mentioning it. In fact, talk of cyber, particularly cyber as a way of getting your project funded, has become so ubiquitous that the top Pentagon official in charge of cyber policy recently joked that during the budget seasons he was seeing a lot of plans for things like the cyber tank and the cyber plane coming across his desk, the implication being that if you want money for your program, just slap the word cyber on it and they'll give it to you. And I think that sort of reveals the degree to which we've also sort of been gripped by this, I don't want to say paranoia, but this sort of fever to start viewing even traditional military functions through this lens of cyber. And it tells you the degree to which those domains are sort of merging together, and we're in very early days about that. So government officials like to talk publicly now about the vulnerabilities in our network, and that's partly because I think they feel it's their responsibility to warn us and to level with us about what's possible, even in these sort of nightmare scenarios, not to mention the day-to-day kind of crime and espionage and fraud that's going on, but also because it helps drum up support for these programs and to get them funded. But I don't think that they're telling us the whole story when we talk about the ways in which America is vulnerable and that we're victimized. Because the truth is, we know how vulnerable we are and all the terrible things that can happen because we're very good at doing those things to other countries, too. And we have a very, very strong sense of our own capabilities in the offensive realm, which is really what the other half of my book is about. And I tell a story that I think illustrates the degree to which we have actually become very good in the offensive side of cyber and how that is also changing the way that we really fight war. This actually goes back to the surge in Iraq in 2006 and 2007. You'll all remember that as part of an effort there to put down the insurgency and to keep the country from spiraling into a civil war, President Bush sent tens of thousands of additional combat troops to Iraq that were going to be part of this sort of reinforcement to bring security and bringing stability back to the country. Well, what's lesser known is that there was a parallel and a tandem effort, really, that went along with that. And it was essentially a cyber operation led by the National Security Agency, which is our largest intelligence agency that is responsible for gathering up information and communications from all over the world. The NSA built the capability in Iraq to effectively own the networks in Iraq. And what I mean by that is they had the ability to collect every phone call, every text message, and every email that was sent inside the country of Iraq. It was an extraordinary technological undertaking. And what they did with all of that information was essentially try to map out the communications networks and therefore the hierarchies and the structures of the networks of insurgents and foreign fighters and roadside bombers and their financiers that were operating in Iraq, essentially trying to use their communications to plot them out and figure out where they were not just operating, but where they were physically located, and that intelligence was then handed off to these additional ground forces who went out and either captured or killed those individuals. I interviewed a guy for the book who was sort of my protagonist in the beginning, who was sort of on the tip of the spear of this operation, as they like to say. It was a young Army lieutenant at the time named Bob Stasio, and he'd been trained in this discipline of signals intelligence, you know, gathering up your enemy's communications to figure out what they're talking about and where they're located. And he gets to Iraq and realizes that we have all this tremendous data, largely from cell phone traffic. And would there be a way to kind of piece that together to find out who the bad guys are? I don't know if any of you are fans of the HBO show The Wire. Does anybody watch that? Well, there's this great character in The Wire who's one of these old, grizzled old detectives who decides that rather than trying to go out and walk the beat and figure out who the drug kingpins and the pushers are in Baltimore, he's actually going to gather up all the records from their disposable cell phones and use that to map them out. And Bob Stasio sort of fashioned himself after this detective and was one of many people really in Iraq who was sort of at the forefront of using this intelligence to marry it up with combat operations on the ground and sort of create this cycle fueled by intelligence gleaned from cyberspace, really. And really a kind of a practical application of an example of cyber warfare, cyber intelligence being used for a what the military would call a kinetic outcome. The NSA hackers did other extraordinary things in Iraq, too, that are really kind of like something out of a spy movie, frankly. They figured out how to hack into the cell phones of individual insurgents and fighters and send them faked text messages, posing as people that they knew and trusted and then luring them into traps. They went on to websites that were sort of bulletin boards and forums that were being used by jihadis and other fighters, and not only watched what they were saying and listened to them, but actually implanted spyware on some of these websites so that people who visited them actually were downloading beacons onto their computers, which would then allow the NSA to spy on their email on that machine, but also in some cases physically locate them. Actually, in a very sort of, you know, almost prescient kind of operation, they also undertook to try and shut down the proliferation of beheading videos, which we forget. We now see all these gruesome videos that ISIS has been propagating out of Syria and Iraq. Well, the predecessor to ISIS was the group that they were fighting, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they were showing these images as well, and there were cases in which the hackers, our hackers, were able to go in and shut those servers down and stop them from proliferating, and in some cases find the people who were actually proliferating them and then shut them down as well. This whole cyber operation, according to people I interviewed for the book, really was the linchpin that made the surge work. It wasn't just the troops on the ground, and in fact, it's arguable that without this cyber component, we might not have seen the albeit temporary success that we did in 2007 and 2008, where the surge achieved at least its temporary objectives, and of course, those were not long-lasting, as we know now. David Petraeus, no less, the commander of ground forces in Iraq, has credited this combination of cyber and ground forces with, quote his words, a prime reason for the significant progress made by U.S. troops in the surge in 2007 and 2008, and, quote, directly enabling the removal of almost 4,000 insurgents from the battlefield. That is a remarkable achievement for any intelligence program, and I think that it really did start to change the way, not just that the NSA spies and the way our intelligence communities think of cyberspace and what you can do in it and with it, but also the way that we are going to fight wars in the future. What that means is that whenever we go to battle again, cyber is going to be a component of this. We are looking at cyberspace now as a place that we can gain advantage, and also that we have to be prepared to do battle with our adversaries as well. And ISIS is, frankly, another case in point of that. So In all of this zeal, though, on the part of the military and the intelligence community to dominate in cyberspace, the government is, in partnership with corporations, I argue in the book, actually making all of us who exist in cyberspace more vulnerable and less secure. Now, we are sort of the non-combatants or the civilians on this new domain. And I write that there are a couple very compelling examples that we've seen lately of ways in which, in this quest to sort of own that domain and be top dog in it, it's weakening security for the rest of us. And I'll give you two of these examples. One is in the way that we know now that the National Security Agency has tried to undermine what's known as encryption. So we're probably all becoming, every day with stories of hackers and the like, becoming more familiar with what encryption is. But basically, it is a way for you to protect the data on your device, your phone, or that's transmitted between you and your bank, to essentially scramble it into a way that's encoded that only you and the recipient can unlock to make that communication as secure as possible. Well, for the National Security Agency, which is in the business of intercepting communications and being able to read them, encryption is a big problem. If bad guys are encrypting data, how can they read it? If terrorists are encrypting their messages, how will we know what they're saying? Well, we know from the Snowden documents that were leaked a few years ago that at least in one instance, the NSA secretly allowed weaknesses in a very popular encryption standard that was then put out and in fact recommended publicly by the agency to exist, which effectively gave the agency a way to unlock that encryption in a way that the people who were using it were not aware of. I liken this in the book to saying that imagine that the government came out and recommended that everybody buy a particular brand of lock to put on their front door. And said, this is the safest lock out there. It will keep out the bad guys. It will keep you safe in your home. Except the government secretly has a key to that lock, and it didn't tell you. And by the way, the key is not particularly all that well hidden. The flaw in the encryption that the NSA knew was there actually could have been found by researchers and hackers, and in fact was found pretty quickly, and thankfully didn't seem to have been that well publicized at the time. Another area where I think that the intelligence community, particularly the NSA, is arguably making us less safe, and there's a huge ethical quandary in all of this, is in the collection of what is called zero-day information or zero-day exploits. Basically, the NSA spends a lot of time looking at technology, software, operating systems, things that are used all around the world, and trying to find vulnerabilities or flaws in those products that would allow it a way into that system to spy on it, to manipulate it, possibly to control it. If you as a hacker can find a vulnerability that's never been discovered and has never been patched, it's known as a zero day, because if you chose to exploit it, there are 0 days to defend against it. This is very prized information that's actually sold on a kind of gray market online. And it turns out that, at least in the United States, the single largest purchaser of zero day information is the National Security Agency. It's buying it, some cases we think directly, some cases we know through a network of contracts that it has with defense contractors, who, by the way, are in that partnership I was alluding to a while ago. And what it does with this information is it tries to essentially stockpiles it and uses it in the arsenal of ways to be able to spy on computers and, in some cases we know of, to be able to actually damage equipment, as happened in the case of the so-called Stuxnet virus, where we damaged centrifuges inside an Iranian nuclear facility using zero-day exploits that were loaded onto software code that was implanted into the computers in the facility. So these actions of undermining encryption and amassing 0 days, I argue, may allow the United States to strike at its enemies more effectively, but it also leaves the vast majority of all of us as users of this very same technology more vulnerable and exposed to attacks. I mean, it doesn't sort of stand to reason that if the NSA wants to be in the business of protecting Americans and protecting cyberspace or helping in that effort, shouldn't it be warning companies when it finds flaws in their systems that could make all of us vulnerable as well? This is something that was actually brought to President Obama's attention about a year ago by a panel of his advisors, who recommended in a public document, you can read it, that the NSA sort of get out of the business of hoarding this information and err on the side of disclosing it. And the president didn't exactly take that advice. I think it's still safe to say that we are in the business of trying to find these vulnerabilities and use them to our intelligence and national security advantage and not necessarily publicly disclosing them. So all of this evolution of cyberspace into a battlefield has happened with practically no debate publicly. The conjunction of a huge war-fighting machine with a growing technology industry is, I think, as President Dwight Eisenhower described, the military-industrial complex, which I'm consciously hearkening to, in a previous generation, is something that, to use his words, is, quote, new in the American experience. And I believe it's actually changing the way that we all use the internet and therefore is profoundly impacting directly on all of our lives. I think that cyberspace is too vast and too pervasive and too important to how we live now to allow a single entity to govern it or to dictate the norms of behavior. And I argue in the book that this authority should not be vested inside an intelligence agency. That is not the place where I think we should be making such profound policy decisions that affect all of our lives. There's no neat way to define cyberspace. It's not a commons, but it's also not private. We've come to depend upon it as a public utility, like electricity and water, but it is still, at the end of the day, mostly a collection of privately owned devices. Yet cyberspace, I think, is undeniably a collective, which is why I think that it's incumbent on everyone who touches it, all of us, to take a stake in how we treat it and to find what President Eisenhower called in his farewell speech to the nation, essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. Thanks very much. So I'd be happy to answer any questions and have a discussion. There are mics here. I can pretty much see them, and I'll try to see you too. So, yes, please go ahead.
I have a question about Stuxnet, because sure. I thought Stuxnet was very sophisticated software, malware written by Israel in the U.S., which has consequently made more vulnerability as a result of the creation of that software. It was the nation state created software. So we have some moral culpability there, don't we?
Yeah, I think arguably we do. And I mean, it's fair to say that with Stuxnet, we sort of fired the first shot in the global cyber wars. You know, this was a piece of code that was jointly written by us and the Israelis that was specifically designed to make equipment break. I mean, to go in and cause damage in a plant, whether you call that sabotage or an act of war, is perhaps debatable, and it certainly has been debated. What happened in that case, and it so gets at sort of the ethical quandary of cyber warfare, is the reason we know about Stuxnet is because reportedly the code that was used in that attack got out. It's not entirely clear to me how it got out, but needless to say, it did not stay confined to inside the facility at Natanz. And cyber weapons are problematic in that once you've used them and somebody picks up the code, they can sort of figure out how to refashion it in a way and use it again. And there's some evidence that the Iranians did that. We know a lot about that operation and how it went down technically. What we don't know a lot about is what were the conversations that happened on the policy and on that ethical kind of level. Did we know that when we did this, I think we probably did, that we were essentially taking the first shot and that we were going to some degree to be responsible for what happened afterwards? And, you know, and part of the what happened afterwards is that Iran retaliated for this in cyber. They launched an attack in 2012 against major banks in the United States. Fortunately, did not do a lot of damage. But there's no denying, I think, that our decision in Stuxnet sort of ignited and created a situation in which countries felt that they were justified in responding to our attack. And it's, in a way, hard to argue that they weren't. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very rich field, especially in terms of the ethical dimensions that you bring up. You place a large onus on the government, which has public accountability to deal with, and there your ethical argument sticks with, like a very, very good pasta on the refrigerator door. But you seem to be, at least so far for the book, avoiding the ethical issues of the private sphere. Mm-hmm. And in particular, what is the ethical responsibility of all these private companies that operate so-called in the marketplace? And the fact that they are specifically opening back doors to our private data without fully informing us, and perhaps the guilt or the onus can be placed on the government for not adequately regulating this marketplace, but when firms like Google are now spending millions on lobbying in Washington, D.C., they recently discovered lobbying. The ethical dimension brings in campaign finance, but more specifically, in terms of touching our daily lives, I would say that Facebook and Google have a much greater effect on us and the security of our banking operations than what the NSA is doing.
Yeah, well said. And there's a lot of the book, particularly in the second half of the book, is devoted to the role of the private sector and the responsibilities of the private sector. So you're right. In the talk I've been giving here today, I'm focusing a lot on the government's role in this. But it is absolutely the case that most of what we would call cyber defense in this country right now is going to be coming from the private sector, number one. There's a huge debate going on right now within the private sector over whether companies who've had their information stolen have a right to what's called hack back at the people who took it from them, raising all kinds of concerns and questions about what is the nature of self-defense in cyberspace. How do you stop a bank from launching a private cyber war with a country? What is the government's role for stepping in and dealing something with that? You know, there's a fascinating little anecdote. In 2012, in this case where the Iran launched these what are called denial of service attacks, sort of traffic floods on bank websites, which are pretty common as attacks go, but this one was especially voluminous. It was like a tsunami, and it scared a lot of people in the banking industry and in Washington. Some of these financial executives came to the Homeland Security Department, and the guy I interviewed in the book told me about this because he was in charge of talking to them. And they said, well, what are you going to do about this, like you being the government? And he kind of looked at them like, we? Like, what do you expect us to do about it? I mean, you want us to go bomb Iran? You know, and I guess maybe you thought that'd be a good idea, too. But, you know, these are the questions that get raised. And for companies and their responsibility as well, you know, it's not just the NSA propping up this market for 0 days. It's corporations as well. We're operating in a tremendous gray zone. You know, I talked in the beginning about how the legal aspects of cyber warfare and cyber espionage are befuddling to people. But there's sort of an arbitrage that occurs, right? You can operate very effectively in a gray zone. The intelligence community is very good at it. And I think companies are right now as well. For them, the big concern is not so much who's going to come to our rescue, but what can we do in our own self-defense? And boy, you talk about unleashing a Pandora's box when you get into that, really. Yeah.
I have a question concerning Apple. Apple supposedly is arguing with the government about putting encryption that can't be broken. And I wonder if you make a guesses how you think that might turn out.
Yeah, so the FBI director, James Comey, has actually made a really big public push to say that basically this device, an iPhone 6, is a national security and law enforcement threat. And I know Director Comey, I've spent some time with him, and I think he's a man of great principle and he's very earnest, but I think he's off base on this one. For starters, the encryption that exists on this phone might prevent you from seeing what's on the phone, but it doesn't prevent you, if you're the government, from going to Apple servers and getting information that's contained there. And I don't know about you, but my phone is backing up to the cloud. It's sort of emitting data all the time. It's not just keeping it. But what this gets at, though, is the extent to which encryption threatens or national security officials think that encryption threatens them and it makes it unable for them to track the bad guys. If everybody has encryption, you know, what's to stop the child pornographers and the drug dealers and the terrorists from using it? And that's true. They do use it. But at the same time, I think that people do have a right to secure their data. I mean, maybe right is a strong word considering we're still in this vague legal territory, but certainly have a very compelling and understandable interest in doing it. Where I think this is going to end up is I don't think the government's going to win this one. We had a debate about this in the 1990s over something called the Clipper chip. It's sometimes called the crypto wars, where the government essentially said, that's great. People can use encryption, but we need to have the key. We need to have the key someplace in escrow and that we can use it whenever we need to unlock the bad guy's communications. And they didn't win that fight. And what we know from a lot of the Snowden documents is that the government is not waiting for a policy change to be able to unlock encryption. You know, it's going out and stealing encryption keys, and it's doing all kinds of really interesting things with intelligence operations to make sure that it can read communications. So with no disrespect to Director Comey, I think he's overstating the degree to which our surveillance apparatus is blinded by the fact that you can't get the data off this particular phone. Yes.
Hello. What the gentleman mentioned two people ago is really, really, it's really, really intense right now. My name is Molasses Jones. That's my artist name. In 2006, I started to use a new social network called MySpace. And I found that that was a great way to connect with other artists. And I decided that I was going to start to build a brand. I had some major connections. And it was great. I was traveling to audition and writing at home. And I thought, wow, this really feels good. I can actually, with the internet, I can have tools that could help me build my brand as an artist, and I wouldn't necessarily have to go through a major brand. However, in those 8 years, I've been creating, and those connections have got my work, my copyright, to the universe, and I haven't made more than $1,000 in those 8 years. My work has been highly publicized, and what I'm getting at is it's really hard for a person, a creator, to defend against what's out there right now. And if you have the government working with Google, and I don't know if anybody has Gmail, but I read the terms of conditions now. If you read the terms of conditions, basically there are lines that say, you give us your information and we can use it and you have no right to defend yourself. It's sad. So my question is to someone out there is, how do you defend yourself when you've been personally, your person and your business and your life has been attacked?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, yeah, and I think your experience with your creative work, and believe me, as somebody who's seen my work, you know, pirated on the internet too, I sympathize to a great degree, is sort of a related but a separate issue from the national security and the surveillance dimensions. But in general, I mean, I think that there are lots of things that we can be doing to protect ourselves. How you get fair compensation for your work, I wish I knew that one, and I feel like if I did, you know, I could become an artist promoter or something. But in general, yeah, there are ways. Encryption is one. Using very strong passwords is another. Sort of learning basic kind of rules of the cyberspace, of the cyber road is helpful. But you're putting your finger on something here, which I think is really important to remember. And a lot of people I've talked to in the cryptology community have said this. You know, if it's us against the NSA, they win. Right? I mean, if it's you against, you know, Google, they win. I mean, it's a very uneven kind of field here when you have great power and resources. If there are positive aspects of the Snowden leaks, and certainly there are, one of them, I think, has been that it has compelled companies, hopefully, to get a lot better about protecting their users' information and seeing that they need to have not just more transparency, but maybe being more of a bulwark against the government. Which is not to say, by the way, and I should say, I don't argue in my book, either of my books, that we've created a Stasi in this country. I'm not being that extreme. But there is tremendous technological capability out there, and most ordinary users are pretty, you know, powerless against it. We make trade-offs all the time in how we give our data over to companies. You know, people have said, we've talked about this earlier today with some of my hosts, saying, you know, look at the information that we willingly give over to Facebook and to Google every day about us. And I guess my response to that has always been, though, that we do that willingly in exchange for some kind of tangible good, right? Some kind of service that we're getting. And ultimately, Google and Facebook don't have guns and they can't put you in jail. So that's another reason to be, I think, deeply skeptical of the government trying to get your information too. Yes.
So it may be a little bit too early for this question, considering how young of a domain cyber warfare is. But have you personally given any thought to, in coming years, if there would be an international agreement akin to the Geneva Convention for, like, what is and is not allowed as far as cyber warfare goes? You know, you can't crash an entire country's economy, but you can attack specific projects that hinder your national security, something like that?
Yeah, in fact, it's a great question. And it's one that's been debated a lot among legal scholars and government officials, the question of whether you could create sort of a cyber arms treaty, you know, a Geneva or a SALT, you know, for cyber. And generally, the response that has come back is that probably not. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that, one, how would you verify it? Right, we can count warheads, and we can see from satellite images when armies are amassing on borders, but how do you count how many zero-day exploits a country has and whether they're going over the limit that they agreed to? And the other is, frankly, because there's really no country right now that is in the lead and kind of dominates cyberspace and everyone's trying to get ahead, there's very little incentive for countries like China, Russia, and the United States, which are the leaders in this area, to sort of preemptively limit how far they can go and tie their hands. So what is happening, though, is that we're sort of developing norms of behavior as we go. And that's actually how I think a lot of the ethical and maybe even the legal boundaries are going to get drawn in cyberspace. I mean, a really good example of this, maybe two. One is Stuxnet. As far as we know, the Iranians did not try to retaliate by blowing up, you know, a power grid or a centrifuge in the United States. Maybe they felt that they were deterred from doing that. Maybe we sort of said this is as far as we could go short of igniting a national response from another country. But there wasn't a huge retaliatory response from that other than the denial of service attacks. Another is the Sony hack. So President Obama came out within days of Sony saying that were being revealed that they had been hacked. And said North Korea was behind this and there will be consequences. And he actually said there will be a proportionate response. And that's a very particular word. That's, you're borrowing from law of armed conflict language, law of war language, when you talk about proportionality. And we did respond with sanctions. And so we sort of drew some lines there, too. And I mean, I think maybe that was arguably a proportional and appropriate response. Now, it's going to create a question of when the next company gets hacked, they're going to look to President Obama and say, well, what are you going to do for me, right? But we are making policy sort of as we go. And it's definitely the case that the military, while it's not become doctrine yet, there are some sort of red lines that even they are seeing. So an attack on our power grid, a major attack on a bank like the one that Henry Paulson and Mike McConnell were describing. And the military has said, I think, pretty clearly in its written guidance on this, that it would view that as something effectively like an act of war and would recommend to the president that he would be within his rights to respond to that, not just in cyberspace. So it is evolving. And while I don't think that there's great hope for a treaty right now, sort of the rules of the road are being kind of drawn out. And for better or for worse, we're a major player in that, as are the Chinese, as are the Russians. And so I think there's great responsibility on us, on our government, to act very judiciously and very cautiously, because people are going to follow our lead and we're going to set precedent by what we do. Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much, and I'll be happy to sign the book for you, too.
Thank you, Shane Harris. Very enlightening, if a bit worrisome topic. But thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.